We'll do it live!
You are listening to the AMC Report with your host, Ryan Dawson.
This is Ryan Dawson of the ANC Report, Anti-Neocons Report. Joining me today is Mr. Dan Sanchez. He's a writer on antiwar.com and also dansanchez.me. You can find all his articles there. Recently, he wrote a piece called Saudi Arabia and Israel, An Axis of Convenience. Now, welcome to the program, sir.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
I want to discuss this article and some previous ones because you give a good history here. I think people, at least in modern times, can put it together that the Saudis and the Israelis, both of whom are based on religious fanaticism — Israel has racial colonies and Saudi Arabia routinely beheads people, even kills people for sorcery and things like that — they have a mutual alliance against the Shia crescent in the Middle East. But this history goes much further back, post-World War. And you wrote this out in your article, and I was hoping you could expand on that a bit. Why are these two countries such bedfellows when it seems like the Zionists would hate the Muslims on the surface?
Well, part of it is what you described. They both have really radical, exclusionary, bigoted ideologies, founding ideologies. Militant Zionism in the case of Israel and militant Wahhabism in the case of Saudi Arabia. But the reason why that plays into an alliance between the two is that both ideologies feed into their role as what I call cat's paws for the America. For the West, because originally
Britain,
there were cat's paws for the British Empire, and then after America inherited Britain's mantle, they inherited the clients of Israel and Saudi Arabia, and so that's really the most fundamental sense in which they tend to be allied, because they both are basically agents of Western colonialism, and they've been agents of Western colonialism since their birth. I mean, that's what they were born as agents of Western colonialism. And they're what I call symbiotic twins in their birth, that they midwifed each other's births, because, as I explained in the article, they were essential when the British Empire kind of ushered them both into existence. It was sort of because of each other. And really what I'm drawing from is this great post on Mondo Weiss that was published recently. And I'm just sort of I was just giving a brief overview of that post. That post goes into more detail. So after reading my article, I really recommend reading the more detailed story of it. And it's by somebody named Numan Abed al-Wahid. And the post is called How Zionism Helped Create the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And so basically what happens is that, I preface that story that Wahid tells with Murray Rothbard's story of how the Middle East crisis began,
because I think two promises there after World War I. What were they, and which one was kept?
Yes. See, the British Empire, in order to get support, promised the Arabs that they would have their independence if they rose up against the Ottoman Turks, who ruled most of the Arab countries at the time. And the Ottoman Turks were enemies of the British in World War I. And so the British promised the Arabs that if they rose up against the Turks, that after they overthrew the Turks, that the British would just let them be independent. And that they wouldn't try to replace the Turks, the Arabs would just be independent. And so that promise was throughout the Arab world. So that would include Arab Palestine. But at the same time, with the Balfour Declaration, they were promising Zionists that Palestine would be given to them as a national home for organized Zionism. And so that's basically the story that Murray Rothbard tells. And he makes the point that he says that the two promises were not on the same moral plane. For in the former case, the Arabs were being promised their own land freed from Turkish domination. And in the latter, world Zionism was being promised a land most emphatically not its own, because it was already populated by Palestinians.
Yes, but God is a real estate agent.
What's that?
I joke, God is a real estate agent. The justification is God gave this land to me.
Right, that's right, yeah. And Murray Rothbard said that it wasn't very surprising that the British Empire ended up keeping its promise to Zionism and not to the Arabs. Because he points out that if it had kept its promise to the Arabs, that would basically mean stepping aside and just leaving the Middle East. But in order to effect the promise to the Zionists, they had to stay. Sort of usher it in.
Also, the Suez Canal was very, very important at the time, and the British didn't want to leave that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's a major factor.
It rolls into the Suez Crisis, Levant Affair, and so on from there. So also in Saudi Arabia, well, I don't know if you want to go all the way back to Bin Saud or not, but the monarchy needs to justify its existence with a particular brand of Islam that believes in monarchy.
Yeah. So I have another article called Playing with Fanatic Fire. And with that one, I go even further not just back to World War I, but all the way to the 1800s, when the first partnership between an earlier Ibn Saud and al-Wahhab, who was the cleric, who was the founder of the Wahhabist sect of Islam, their partnership and where al-Wahhab would preach the right to rule of Saud, and Saud in return would use his force of arms to propagate Wahhabism. And so that had already had a history for many, many decades before World War I came about. But then with World War I, the Ibn Saud had already taken the side of Britain against the Ottomans, but the Ottomans had crushed the Saudi forces. And so the Saudis weren't very militarily useful to Britain for a while, but then Sharif Hussein bin Ali, who's the ruler of a part of Western Arabia called the Hejaz, he agreed to turn against the Ottomans, again, as Murray Rothbard explained, under the promise that they would the Arabs would attain independence afterwards. And so he really led the Arab revolt that overthrew the Ottomans. But then afterwards, when the British reneged on their promise, Hussein didn't just accept it. He refused to acquiesce to either Sykes-Picot, which was the partition of the Arab world into British and French spheres. So it was basically carving up the Arab world for Western imperialism. And he refused to acquiesce to the implementation of the Balfour Declaration and the consignment of Arab Palestine to Zionist colonization. And this was in spite of intense pressure that the British would bully him and threaten him and offer bribes. And chief among the diplomats doing this was Winston Churchill, actually. and T.E. Lawrence of
Lawrence of Arabia
fame. So, and the main threat that they delivered was that if you do not play ball, if you do not accept the Balfour Declaration and Sykes-Picot, then we're going to sic Ibn Saud on you and his fanatic Wahhabi followers. And when they realized that he wasn't going to relent, that's exactly what they did. And basically, and before that, he had actually been sicked on another Arabian ruler, and so the British basically gave him the green light and the support because he was heavily in the British on the British payroll, that he was getting a lot of gold regularly. And so he was able to conquer most of Arabia, and then the British rewarded him by upgrading his emirate to a kingdom, and it was actually a British functionary that came up with that coined the name Saudi Arabia, and so a big part of why they were they were lifted up in this way, the Saudis were lifted up, was because they were willing to play ball, and they weren't as intransigent as Hussein against the Zionist project in Palestine. And so because that's how they came to power, Zionism helped the Saudis. But because the Saudis were the ones that eliminated the obstacle to Zionism, the vice versa was true as well, that the Saudis helped Zionism and ultimately Israel come to be.
Right. Now I want to walk through a few decades of history real quick. So they had, under Eisenhower, the British and the French and the Israelis attacked the Egyptians under false pretexts and false flags. And it was the Americans that put the peace deal in charge. And they said from 1957 to 1967, we're going to have UN peacekeepers here. Weeks after they were removed, they had the 1967 war where they sank the Liberty and so on. And Nasser had also been allied with Yemen at the time against the Saudis when they were attacked by the Israelis. And so they seem to be bedfellows for a while. And you have this divide in the intelligence community too. James Jesus Angleton from Kennedy Onward was a he had two passions in life, anti-communism and pro-Zionism, and he passed the torch over to William Shatley, and then they create the Safari Club post-Watergate, which the Israelis had already had an axis with the Americans, and then they added Saudi Arabia, Morocco, France. And the Safari Club's where you get Prince Turki, who was the predecessor of the famous Vandar Bush, who may or may not have been involved with 9/11, his 28 pages rhetoric, da da da. So they are together that whole time. But during the second Iraq war, there seems to be a divide because the Saudis were opposed to the second Iraq war. And the Israelis, of course, pretty much cooked it up with the Office of Special Plans and all the pre-war rhetoric and lies, Odet and Yon, et cetera. So how did they get together after such a divide there with the second Iraq war? What was it? Because the first Iraq war, the Saudis were angry about American troops being stationed there. But during the second war, how did they rekindle their relationship with the Israelis?
Well, basically, because the Iraq war was a done deal, then it made things simpler because then a Shia regime was in charge in Baghdad, and the whole war kind of backfired for Israel because the regime was not pro-Israel. It was actually very beholden to Israel's enemy, Iran. So so at that point, their interests were more tightly aligned because it just so happened that all of Israel's remaining enemies, which is any kind of independent, stable, rational Muslim or Arab country, happened to be Shia. And the Saudis are very anti-Shia, so then it became simpler, because you're right that the Saudis opposed the Iraq war. There's a, I think it was a State Department cable that WikiLeaks released that where one of the Saudis said that they had, that the America had handed Iraq on a golden platter to Iran. Mm-hmm.
Because they had a Ba'athist Sunni regime before, and now it's Shiite.
Right, right. So, so it was secular, and the Saudis don't like secular regimes very much. But at least it was Sunni, and it was enemies with Iran, which Saudi hated even much more. And so, so the Saudis were saying, like, you know, we had it good. It was you, me, and Saddam, and we were containing Iran, and now you've handed Iraq on a golden platter. He doesn't say silver platter; he says golden for some reason. I don't know if he didn't know the idiom or if he
they just like gold,
or if he was just trying to exaggerate. But yeah.
Well, I mean, Saddam was Sunni, so I guess that religion supports the monarchy in Saudi Arabia. However, he also did support Palestinians, so the Israelis really wanted to get rid of him, regardless of who came next. But it seemed like, I mean, that's all of their prolific writers in the, you know, Weekly Standard, PNAC, etc., are just trying to get any excuse they could to get a war in Iraq. You think they just didn't see the outcome of a Shia Iraq, or it didn't matter?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like they didn't see the outcome. I cover this in another article called "Seize the Chaos," and also "Clean Break to Dirty Wars." And basically, the plan plan for overthrowing Iraq was, before the build up to the actual Iraq war. So we're talking like back in the 90s. The plan was that that they'd actually have a Hashemite monarchy. So the Hashemite royal family is the royal family that rules Jordan, and they are clients of the U.S. and so they're very pro-Israel. And so the idea was that Iraq would actually get its own Hashemite king, and then Iraq would be pro-Israel after that. But then by the time the buildup to the Iraq war came, because earlier they were more planning on doing it through sort of covert means and just by destabilizing Iraq, and David Wormser thought that it was on the verge of crumbling, and so that it wouldn't take like a full-scale war to do it.
Yeah, but Wolfowitz then thought it was a cakewalk.
Yeah, but then by the time, not even just doing any kind of war at first, like in the 90s, Wormser was talking about destabilizing it, not through war, but just through sort of covert means.
They did have very, very brutal sanctions on Iraq. I mean, half a million people were dead by 97, and they still had six more years of sanctions. So, I mean, they had a lot of brutality there, not necessarily war, but you know, right, the oil for food program. There were a lot of economic assaults on Iraq.
Right, right. But once they were set on doing a full-scale American invasion, then that kind of took the monarch route off the table, because it just would look good if an American high-profile war installed a monarchy in a Middle Eastern country. And so then they were hoping for Ahmed Chalabi to sort of take the reins of the government and be sort of the leading light in the new Republican government. They would still be like a democratic government, and they were hoping that Ahmed Chalabi would use his influence over especially the this one particular Shiite cleric that he was hoping that his influence over the Shiite cleric would turn the Shia in Iraq and in Syria against Assad and against Iran. And but Chalabi was basically a con man. There's a great article.
Yeah, he was convicted of bank fraud, wasn't he? But Judith Miller and they used Chalabi and the INC as sources for their what was actually their own propaganda to start the war in Iraq. And he did become the oil minister, I believe, or like the equivalent of vice president. But he never made it into leadership. But yeah, he was definitely a fraudster.
Right, and there are indications that he had no intention on turning Iraq pro-Israel. One of his relatives told a story that saying that he was assuring him like, oh, you know, don't worry, I'm just playing the neocons. I'm not actually going to help them, and it turned out later that he had really close ties with Iran, so he might have even been basically an Iranian spy. So a lot of neocons like really turned on him because they started realizing that they were just getting played.
Well, it was easy to play him. They were so bellicose for Iraq that they would accept anything. It seems like they believe whatever they need to, whatever fits their ideology, and regardless of the facts. So that brings us to, you start having ISIS in Iraq, although they were pretty much defeated until the Syrian conflict. And I like this term backdraft, although I don't even agree that a lot of what is called blowback is blowback, because it says it's unintended consequences. And I'm so cynical that I think they intend the consequences, but
right.
They want to have plausible deniability like Iran-Contra, where they go, oh, we didn't know that was going to happen, but how could you not? I mean, I don't know. I flip-flop. They're either incredibly incompetent or they're just sinister. And I seem to lean more towards they're just sinister most of the time. But anyway, then you have ISIS. Now, it starts with the FSA, which is basically ISIS. And then they get rebranded because, I'm basing this on what they did. They've all been cutting off heads and eating organs and all that. You have al-Nusra. And so they're rebranded as ISIS. And again, you have the Israelis acting as ISIS's air force and apparently medical staff, and the Saudis openly funding them, arming them. And yet, we've never taken the steps to say, knock that off. We want to supposedly bomb ISIS, which I think is a cover for blowing up infrastructure in Syria. But why hasn't the U.S. said, hey, Saudi Arabia, Israel, quit aiding terrorists?
Because they are adopting Israel's priorities. I think that they're more intent on overthrowing Assad than they are of actually eradicating ISIS. So I think that they don't really want they want plausible deniability. So that it's, you know, distant enough from them, but they want, you know, Turkey and the Saudis and Qatar and in some ways Israel to basically be supporting the jihadis, because they're the most effective tool for overthrowing Assad.
It's a nice way of laundering a lot of weapons too, especially aircraft. But I have a slight disagreement here, because I don't think the goal is to actually oust Assad. I think the goal is to wreck Syria, and they're actually intentionally prolonging the conflict as long as possible, so where they have a balance, where there's war, but they don't actually go and get them. They just keep it in this ebb and flow. That's sort of like Vietnam. They could have won that war in a matter of weeks, but then you can't sell helicopters. This is a way of prolonging the conflict to wreck Syria permanently. That's my opinion.
That's a good point, and that's very plausible. Because when what's his name, the former ambassador the former Israeli ambassador to Michael Oren. He's the former Israeli ambassador to the U.S. He would say that if we have to choose, if one side has to beat the other, that they would actually prefer ISIS and Al-Qaeda to win against Syria and Iran. And he was very forthright about that. But you get the sense that he's saying, if we have to choose, and that he doesn't really want to have to choose. And so there's another quote of another Israeli, forget whether he was some kind of insider, where he says, let them both hemorrhage. He says that that's the strategy here, is that we want them to both hemorrhage. And so it's better if neither side wins. So your thesis is directly supported by an actual quote.
Well, before the clean break strategy, which you talked about but didn't name, Richard Perle wrote that for Netanyahu, and he screws up on basic grammar. But anyway, before that, there was the strategist Oded Yanan, who wrote this policy paper of every Arab-on-Arab conflict and how it benefits. And it was in the 80s. However, this seems to be the playbook for Iraq and Syria. And it may have been the U.S. If they were really aiming at regime change, maybe they thought it would be like another Libya, quick and done, and move on into Ukraine. But I don't think so. I think it may have started off, like you said, but there are a lot of other interests at heart, weapons industries, energy industries, it's not just the Israelis and Saudis, and that this prolonged conflict, not only does it break Syria, but because you see how involved the Turks are, and they don't align with this, that Turkey's interest there, you have a cover to kill the Kurds, as they've been doing, but also it protects their monopoly of the BTC oil and gas pipeline, which goes to Israel, that's where it shoots through before it goes east to China, When the U.S. was moved out of Iraq is exactly when this conflict in Syria starts, because they signed a $10 billion pipeline deal between Iran, Iraq, and Syria, which, because it has to go to Syria to reach a port, you have to have a port to transport it everywhere else. Keeping a conflict going, just like in Afghanistan, prevents no investor, no consortium is going to invest in a pipeline when there's ongoing conflict. And so it prevents that from breaking that energy monopoly. So I think that those interests come into play as well, because it's just, they've had so many chances where even the FSA, they had temporary peace agreements and then they come back. It's like they're trying to balance it on purpose. Mm-hmm. Seems what it says, but yeah, you know, it's hard to prove either way. I mean, they may be trying to kill Assad, but.
So I found the quote. It's Alon Pincus. And he's a former Israeli consul general in New York. And the quote was, this is a playoff situation in which you need both teams to lose, but at least you don't want one to win. We'll settle for a tie. Let them both bleed, hemorrhage to death. That's the strategic thinking here. As long as this lingers, there's no real threat from Syria. So if they do have some sort of plan that, aside from chaos, then maybe their first preference would be like basically just a stooge, just like a puppet monarch or a puppet.
Yeah, Saudi Arabia 2.0 or something, because they definitely favor that over Assad, Saddam Hussein, or Arafat, even though Arafat was bribed off eventually, but they prefer the crazies because it's good for business.
Yeah, well, it's good for business, and it can also be a catalyst for war, because the last thing that they want is for a stable, independent power that their American patrons can live with persisting. And so that's why they're so hell-bent on overthrowing relatively harmless rulers like Assad and Saddam and Gaddafi, because you know that status quo could maintain for a long time, mm-hmm. Israel will never get its conquests of Lebanon, never will basically get access to the resources in the region. And they're always worried that any kind of independent Arab force will even just moral support. Even, I mean, Saddam wasn't subsidizing
Palestine
Palestinians that much, but even just the moral support, you know, that can be really threatening for their occupation. And so they would rather have the crazy head choppers, because they know that America will not coexist with them. That it's much more likely to elicit a full on occupation and a full on invasion, because they're so scary, and because it's such a terrorism emanating refugee hemorrhaging situation
that
the Americans wouldn't be okay living with.
I do want to point out that Bashar al-Assad is several cuts above Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi. He's been really demonized. They say he's starving his own people, he's killing his own people, etc. But people forget that he was the president for 10 years without any of that conflict or starvation or murder or anything. I mean, for the Middle East, he was probably the most secular and progressive guy on the block. I mean, they had a pretty high standard of living and good economy in Syria until this conflict started under Bashar al-Assad. Now, his father fighting with the Muslim Brotherhood is a different story, but we're not talking about his father. We're talking about him. I think he's been greatly demonized unfairly.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll have people who support Palestine, who oppose the Iraq war, and then yet when it comes to Syria, they think, oh, Assad's a monster, so is ISIS. And it's just not the case.
Yeah. So, I have another article called War is Realizing the Israelizing of the World.
you have the best titles.
Thanks. And so, yeah, I discussed the Yunnan plan in that, and I sort of theorize what the long game might be for the Israelis. And then in the earlier article, the long game for the long war. For like the military-industrial complex, what their long game for all this is.
But, right. Do you think the Republicans or the Democrats will bring up any of these nuanced positions in the debates?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
It was interesting in their closing statements, like 10 of them or so, I don't know the number, a lot of them started talking about Israel out of the blue in their closing statements to become president of the United States. They're all talking about another country.
Right. Especially Rubio.
Yeah. The neocons are really backing Rubio now. It's
pretty
disgusting. Trump, yeah. I don't like him, but what he did tell them, like, oh, you don't like me because I don't need your money. And then they all threw their money behind Rubio.
Right. Right.
Sheldon Adelson and,
Yeah, and for him, it's like he'll be belligerent at times, but it's just for his own personal reasons. It's not for like any kind of neocon or Israeli agenda. And so,
he's legitimately just like he is. But it's sad because this is pretty disgusting or irony. I don't know the right word, but when people like Jeb Bush and Donald Trump seem like the moderates on the stage, you have a real problem because.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, given the choices, Rand Paul is the least bad, but Trump's probably number two because at least he opposed the Iraq war. He is willing to work with the Russians. He doesn't agree with aiding al-Qaeda. He's against Common Core. I don't like Common Core. But some minor things, and the rest is pretty crazy. But, compared to Lindsey Graham or Rubio or some of these other guys, they're crazy. I mean, I can't believe that, again, out of 300 million people, we don't have one anti-war candidate from either party.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, they're running for the head of a war machine. So, I mean, it's not really to be expected. That's what this empire is. And it can't be repurposed to anything contrary to its main function. And so... So that's why I think it's just such a big distraction, because it really dumbs down the conversation, and these debates just
What, you mean like saying the pyramids were full of grain?
Yeah. And it just, sucks out all the oxygen. I mean, a lot of, great analysts are instead of spending time analyzing like policy, and I'm talking about journalists, that they're spending time on the horse race and personalities
Yeah.
and for
So
me,
they're
like,
talking about Donald Trump's hair.
And the thing is that it doesn't really, what they actually their stated positions don't actually, necessarily mean that that's going to be the way they govern anyway. So like, trying to like read their intentions and thinking that that's some sort of predictor.
It's like Ted Cruz saying, "Yeah, I want to audit the Fed," and then they have a vote to audit the Fed, and he doesn't even show up.
Exactly. Yeah. And so many, so many presidents where, they seemed like they were going to be belligerent and then they actually were pretty moderate and vice versa, where they talked, they campaigned on keeping, keeping your boys out of war. That's what FDR said. And,
George Bush said that. He says, "We don't need a regime change. If we do go to war, we need a clear exit strategy." He literally said that.
Right. Between Bush and Gore, he was the one running on a humble foreign policy.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's really just a big,
Although Gore would have done the same, just want to say.
yeah, who knows? I mean,
It's
he might
the
not.
thing is, when the Democrats do it, at least when a Republican's president, there's a chance of an anti-war movement that's really an anti-Republican movement. But when, like, Obama's been doing all the same things, there's no resistance. There aren't protests in the streets like there were when Bush was doing it.
Right, and so that's another way where it just doesn't make sense to put your hope in politics, because the things that the presidents are better at in office, that in the long run they end up being worse for that cause, because like what we're going through now with Obama, like you say, that it just took all the wind out of the sails of the peace movement. Just the peace movement is just
Well,
like completely
they kind
moribund.
of bestowed upon him what they wanted to see instead of what he was. If you looked at his Senate record, he was always pro-war. He's always pro-Patriot Act. He didn't actually lie. People lied to themselves because he had a D next to his name, so they thought he would be different than Bush. But if you look at every stance he ever took, every vote he ever made was exactly like he is now. It's not like he 180'd. He just stayed how he always was.
Yeah.
And I blame the public for that. I mean, they're the ones that thought he was so anti-war. He never said he was.
Yeah.
There's
And
one
so,
quote where he said he'd get rid of combat troops after redefining what counts as a combat troop, but that was it, really.
yeah. And it's arguable that he is not quite so grandly disastrous as Bush was, with the Afghanistan war and the Iraq war. But what Obama is doing is terrible. But
I don't know. They bombed a hospital. He
right,
tripled
but
the size of the war in Afghanistan, and we're over there protecting the Northern Alliances of raping little boys and stuff. It's just, and then he had Libya. He
hey,
bombed Somalia. Drone strikes in Yemen, Pakistan. It's like, I don't know.
no, yeah, I know all those details, but at the same time, it's just that, all that kind of stuff was happening, in the Iraq War also. I mean, and so,
True.
and the Iraq War was just like a full scale invasion and occupation, and all of the crimes that are bundled up in that.
And we
And
use depleted uranium and MK-77 white phosphorus, a lot of weapons that we tell everyone else are illegal. We're dropped on Fallujah, dropped on cities, not military
exactly.
bases, just dropped on cities, like cities where houses and everything.
Exactly. So my point is that even if Obama is, marginally better in foreign policy than Bush, the thing is that for the cause of peace and for the reputation of peace, he's so much worse, because so many of his interventions are lower profile. And so they do have their negative consequences, but then when those negative consequences hit, they're blamed on his alleged non-interventionism.
Right. I mean, oh, you didn't stay long enough, that kind of thing.
Right. I mean, that's the narrative. That's the narrative that people are swallowing right now, is that Obama pulled out. You know, Obama's doing the Iran nuclear deal. Obama pulled out.
I think he would have done a hot war like Iraq in Syria. It got voted down. But basically, we remember when George Bush Sr. said we kicked the Vietnam syndrome when he had the first Gulf War?
Yes.
I think Vietnam was so bad that we had the Vietnam syndrome, where for a time period they couldn't overtly go in and invade, like send in the cavalry like they used to. So they did the proxy force stuff like Iran-Contra and El Salvador death squads. They would, you know, pay off proxies and paramilitary, and they would use narcotics money and launder, blah, blah, blah. And post Iraq war, we have the Iraq war syndrome, just like Vietnam. So we're back to the Iran-Contra method, which is, to me, the parallels between the Contras and ISIS are almost perfect. I mean, they both killed journalists. They publicly denounce it. Privately, they finance it. You know, our own DIA admits it. So I think Obama would have been just like Bush with the hot war. It's just he's dealing with the backlash of the Iraq war, where after that war, you couldn't start another one. So he went back to the Reagan model of proxies.
Exactly. Yeah. And an even closer parallel is, I mean, at the same time, also during the Reagan administration, it was when you had the Mujahideen being sponsored by the U.S. and by the Saudis. Yep. In Afghanistan. And that's it was out of that Osama bin Laden was able to recruit a militia that later became Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And it was out of that the Taliban came to be. And so
and ultimately led to September 11th, was the Caucus of Ally. And right. It was George Bush's father. He was the director of the CIA, which helped form the Safari Club, which was the Nexus Alliance between Israel and Saudi Arabia. It's the Safari Club's the one that set up BCCI, which financed the Mujahideen and Al-Qaeda. This is where it starts. I mean, so and then it passes on to his son. And so if we had not set up this backdoor CIA during Carter, then there wouldn't have been a Safari Club. There wouldn't have been a Mujahideen. We wouldn't have had conflict in Afghanistan. There wouldn't have been an Al-Qaeda. It's just one thing leads to another. But I don't see it as blowback. I think it's intentional.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to that. I mean, you can see that with Iran, the Iran-Iraq war that you had, them basically backing both sides, in the 80s, and so you know you could see that they want just conflict and they just want disasters.
That gives more credence to the Syria conflict, like keeping it balanced on purpose. That's a good example too with the Iran-Iraq war. They funded both sides. They wanted to hemorrhage and kill each other.
Right, and so I mean, in the Yunnan plan, he says that every kind of inter-Arab confrontation will assist us in the short run and will shorten the way to the more important aim of breaking up Iraq into denominations, as in Syria and in Lebanon. And so, it's divide and conquer.
The goal of balkanization. Because in that one, they wanted a Kurdish area, a Shiite and Sunni area. Not one to dominate the all, but to divide it in three sections was their hope.
Yeah.
Which almost happened, and kind of has happened with the Kurdish North. They're pretty much independent.
Mm-hmm.
We don't draw them on the map, but they're still there.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's very interesting, and do you see any solutions to this? I mean, making people aware of the Israeli influence or Saudi influence. I mean, we have papers about 9/11 even showing some foreign countries. We don't know which ones, but we do. And we can't even get half of the Congress to even look at it. They haven't even read it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just the 28 pages. I mean, the whole report, they haven't read any of it. And 90% of it's not redacted and does talk about Omar Bayoumi and all this, you know, Saudi influence. And they're just walking around free. It's just amazing. And the press doesn't hold their feet to the fire either. I mean, you have, right? I mean, anti-war has some, but I'm talking about the televised press. They just la-di-da, you know, cheerleading for war.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that the only way that things are going to fundamentally change is if more and more people have a fundamentally different outlook on what the federal foreign policy apparatus is. You know, not just that it's you know, been mismanaged or anything like that. That, you know, throughout history, it has just been just an engine of chaos for the sake of power and wealth, and so until we stop, you know, with sort of the policy wonk type approach, things aren't going to fundamentally change, because as long as you've, you know, sort of accepted the basic premises, then the incentives, the built-in incentives of the empire are also always going to steer policy towards more disastrous things. And so it's not an issue of you know, convincing politicos and bureaucrats to not be so mean and stupid. It's an issue of convincing the public that this is your number, this is your enemy, that this is your nemesis. Mm-hmm. And that this war machine is your nemesis, and that's what the federal government, federal foreign policy apparatus is. It is a war machine, and then when people just recognize it for what it is, then they're not going to be willing to support it anymore. And so really, that's it's sort of a, it has to be more of an indirect pull towards peace. That
we need a social change before any political change can happen. Right, yeah. Last quick question. Are you going to the conference that Grant Smith is holding, the anti-APAC? Well, it's not called that. It's called, is the lobby good or bad or something? But it's March 18th. And I think some writers from anti-war are going to be there. I'm going to go. I think that's a crucial step, is recognizing the power of the lobby. And,
yeah, I'm not going to be able to make it to that one, but I agree that recognizing, you know, foreign influence on government policy, but also like recognizing in the opposite direction, because like I really do consider the Saudis and Israelis as colonial cat's paws, that it's not just, they're not just leading, you know, the big dumb empire by the nose into you know, quagmire after quagmire, that the empire is using them too. And
yeah. Well, they never had a chance, really, like, because the empire financially backed all the extremists, both in Israel and Saudi Arabia. That Israel never had a chance. It's not like Judaism was always that way. It's just that the nuts are the ones that got support by the British and Americans and took charge of the government in Israel, and then it perpetuates itself. You know, had they backed peace candidates, then they would have won, but they didn't want that. They wanted the hardline, crazy, you know, Jewish fanatics in there, racial supremacy and all that. That fits well with colonialism. So those states, from their inception, never really had a chance at being peaceful.
Yeah, and Judaism, you know, still is basically, you know, peaceful, that and not supportive of the Likudniks. I mean, most Jewish people throughout the world, they're anti-Likudnik. You know, right. that they tend to be more Democrats and more, you know, in favor of you know, not being so relentlessly colonialist and just, you know, dispossessing the Palestinians, and
nothing causes more anti-Semitism than the behavior of the Israeli state.
Right, and so that's what's so corrosive about it, is that people like Netanyahu, that they try to blur any kind of distinction. Like they want Israel to be the banner carrier of Judaism, when even though it's not, but because they want any criticism of Zionism and any criticism of Israel to be seen as anti-Semitism, because that just gives them this huge this huge shield, because then you're just not allowed in polite society to criticize their policies. But the thing is that
you have the empathy from World War II, I guess, because it doesn't really work for Saudi Arabia. When people criticize Saudi Arabia, you don't generally get, oh, you're just Islamophobic. People understand, like, no, Saudi Arabia sucks, you know. But they don't, I think World War II plays a lot into that, because you have to have new Hitlers, and so the war machine is behind that.
Right. But the thing is that you couldn't dream up a more anti-Semitic program than to do that, because the thing is that, like you said, is that if you do successfully yoke Judaism with Zionism and Israel in the minds of people, then Judaism is wrongly given the blame for all the crimes of Israel, and that can only breed
anti-Semitism. Also, there's only one state, whereas with Saudi Arabia, you can compare it to all these other states where people are Muslim and don't behave that way, but you don't have that contrast with the Israeli state. And so, they're really just hurting themselves.
That's a good point, yeah.
Well, thank you for coming on today. I enjoy your work on both your sites, both on anti-war. I always read your column, and I've been recently just going directly to your site. That's dansanchez.me, like Middle East, or me.
And then, just like me.
Yeah, I just was saying Middle East. Of course, antiwar.com has a lot of prolific writers, but I've really been enjoying your columns and following it on ISIS and Syria in particular, because I think you get it the best of what I've seen. So I'm really glad you came on the show today.
Well, thank you. And if you have any articles, because I have not read about the Safari Club, and that sounds really interesting.
Oh, I have a 5-hour movie I'll send you.
Okay.
I'll tell you where to skip to this part. It's really instrumental on how the CAA, it can't be explained quickly, but you definitely should, you'll dig it, trust me.
Yeah, and then the whole, like, what is it, BCCI? And funding the Mujahideen.
So yeah, they set up a bank in Pakistan, but it was set up by the Saudis, by this family with direct relationship to the Bush family. And Prince Turki is the one that creates this bank. And this was the bank that they used to launder money to all the paramilitary groups everywhere, Jandala and EK, but Mujahideen in particular. And it went under eventually. So they went back to Riggs Bank. Riggs Bank's where they, before BCCI, they used Riggs Bank to launder money. And Riggs Bank was used during 9/11. That's where Omar Bayoumi gave it to Marie Dalla Cook, and then through his wife to two 9/11 hijackers who were in San Diego, Hazmi and Al-Mihdhar, which the CIA had witnessed at a Malaysia summit meeting for Al-Qaeda, knew they were in the U.S., knew they were going to fly schools, didn't tell the FBI. It's a long story, but there's a lot of either incompetence or sinister activity even during 9/11. And so when people look and say, well, we're working with Al-Qaeda before 9/11, we're working with Al-Qaeda now, with ISIS, after 9/11. But during 9/11, there was no relationship. And I just am very skeptical about that, because I can prove there was one.
Wow, yeah, send me that movie. That sounds fascinating.
It's the movie I made. So it's called It's called The Empire Unmasked. And it starts with the narcotic trade from the 30s. Because like you said, this has been the empire, like, I couldn't go over all the Indian Wars because that's another movie, but I started from the 30s onward with Latin America and just showing, like, look, this has been this growing cancer the whole time. This is not new to this era, and how they used to fund with narcotics trafficking and so on, and how it bleeds into what we have today. So I'll mail it to you.
Okay. Thanks, Ryan.
Sure. I'll have you back on in the future too.
Oh, I'd be happy to come back on.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Dan Sanchez of antiwar.com. You can see him on the right column there, usually right under Justin Raimondo, Dan Sanchez. If you would like to purchase The Empire Unmasked, the film that was mentioned in this broadcast, go to ancreport.com and click on the Buy Now button right underneath the sinister-looking red skull with an Uncle Sam mask that he's moving out of the way. The Empire Unmasked is $20, but it's 5 hours. It would take you many years to gather all this research. It is definitely worth it, and it helps fund these programs and future films, working on one on the Kennedy assassinations right now.
You're all slaves, and you love it. So you deserve what you get. The erosion of your democracy. You'll soon be the laughing stock of the world.
It's all lies, like the sites, Pico or Queen and genocide, kept aside, yeah, locked up in secret, Nanjing Holocaust, Animus Christians lost, West Papa people turn, straight into compost, to bed and slain in vain, how horrific is the pain, when activists detain, get down, piss on the remains, navigate my tears through the rain, please explain, my only Kardashian, and they hit your goddamn brain.